Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes.
And it is season six. Womp, womp,
womp, womp, womp. Okay, welcome back. Oh my God, I can't believe we're season six.
I know.
Time is flying.
I wish we had that syndication money that you get from TV when you go into season six.
Y'all, if you know any syndicators, is that what it's called? Is that how this business works?
No. We don't even want to do that, Miriam. We want a rich person to just give us money.
Ooh. Okay. If anyone knows a rich person that could give us money,
yes,
send them our way.
They could write it off as charity, I think.
Yeah, we're pathetic.
Yeah. That. Yes, and I will say I am so happy to see you. We had a couple weeks break, but I'm feeling a lot better, as you can tell.
Yay.
I got a good night's sleep.
Yes.
Miriam's like, why have you not been on camera? Why are you hiding? I'm like, don't look at me. I'm the elephant woman. No.
Okay, let me be clear. This is the first time I have seen Lavetta. Like, she has not let me see her. We've talked on the phone all the time. Will not let me see her.
Oh,
first time.
You didn't want to see none of that. I didn't want to traumatize you.
I like being traumatized. It's fun.
No, it was not pretty. you ever be so ugly when you go past a mirror, you're like, oh, who is that? And you're just like, oh, is there a stranger in my house? Like, who's this ugly stranger?
I want to say no, but that's an absolute yes.
It's like, or if you smell yourself and you're like, oh, girl, no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So
armpits down, get yourself to the shower. Yep.
That's why there's that commercial that runs all the time. Those actors must be making so much money. It's about the deodorant for other parts of the body.
Yeah.
And the girl's like, oh, I have a secret more than my armpit stinks. She's so funny.
I was like, I think every woman watched that commercial and went, oh shit.
Yeah.
No.
Also, part of me is like, girl, don't let out our secrets. No.
I know. I was like, that's not true. What? Except it's absolutely true. What? Shh.
Yeah, don't do that. But
I smell like roses all the time.
All the time. Okay. I fart roses. That's,
yes.
That's what we do over here.
Loudly. Like, what?
But speaking of secrets, women's secrets.
Yes.
Should we jump in for our new season and get into our ladies? I believe you are first this week,
my dear.
You. Okay. So who is your notorious? Who's your notorious woman?
It hasn't been that long. Can you not say notorious anymore?
Notorious. I mean, apparently... half of the last episode of season five, I mispronounced my lady.
You did that. That was real.
I'm turning to my grandmother. I'm mispronouncing things. R.I.P. Grandma. Like, I'm mispronouncing things, getting people's names wrong. You know.
It's fine.
It's
fine. It adds character.
Yes, because we are what? Hashtag not historians. We're just
hashtag not historians.
A couple funny ladies who are like, let's get into these evil and heroic women, you know, so.
Yes.
You know, because again, murder. I love a murderess. Yeah.
She does love a murderess.
I do.
All right. So. But I'm not about to talk about a murderess today.
Okay.
I am going to talk about a woman named Martha Gellhorn.
Oh.
Have you heard of her?
I vaguely, I think I know who this is, but I don't know a lot about her. So
the more I read about her, the more I was like, we should all know all about her really, really well. And so I am here to do my part now. So, okay. Last month, did you know was Jewish culture month?
Mm. No, I did not. I'm sorry.
So I want to be like, I totally knew that, but I didn't know that at all. And it was last month. So listen, she's half Jewish.
Okay.
So on her father's side, but still, and that's the only part I'm going to talk about, but I want my people to know that I found out eventually about last month.
No, you're going to have to lose your Jewish card for at least a month. I've had to lose my black card a couple times.
You have? No, that's fair.
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Okay. Listen, I had three Seders for Passover this year. Granted, because I was invited to three separate ones. Matzah got old after a minute. I'm not going to lie. It's not that good. I'll say it. You don't have to take a bite and tell your Jewish friend that it's delicious because it's
Don't worry. Mm.
It's like a cracker with no flavor. Wow. Thank you so much.
The Jewish community in America has given us pickles. So to that, I say Mazel tov. Okay. Because I love a pickle.
Love a pickle too.
I love a kosher garlic.
A kosher like dill. Mm. Listen, I married a man, obviously not Jewish, and here's why. He likes the sweet pickles. I mean, not sure why I married him, but I guess it's too late, they say, at this point, you know?
I mean, he is Italian, though. The Italians bring other things to the table. I
yeah,
mean,
you know what I'm
lots
saying?
Of
that's
delicious
true.
Things.
I mean,
so, like, we'll give salad pass.
Although I make better Italian food than he does. It's fine. Does it? Actually, the Rouse jar makes really good Italian food in my house. P.S. If the people of Rouse are listening, we can advertise.
It's I discovered it recent. Well, in the past couple of years, I was like, oh, my God, this is a game changer. That is excellent sauce.
We haven't talked in too long. This is a problem. But listen, at Costco, you can get it for much cheaper. And I've just because it's like $13 a jar now. It's like really expensive. But you could get for like $11, two big jars. Anyways, Rouse should sponsor us.
Yes,
and so
excellent.
Should Costco.
Yes.
Let's talk about a woman.
Yes.
Okay. So Martha Gellhorn, I got information from her from Wikipedia, from NicholasShakespeare.com, and some stuff from the New York Times. And there is some not historians. Not massively, but like...
There's some discrepancies.
She didn't marry him. She did marry him. Like, you'll see.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Okay. So she was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1908 on November 8th. Her mother was Edna Fischel Gellhorn, who was a suffragist. Oh. And her dad was George Gellhorn, who was a German gynecologist. I assume he was born in Germany and immigrated to the States. So that's why I don't think it's a certain form of gynecology, you know, like a focus in medical school. I think he was just German. But hashtag not historians.
Only saw German patients.
Right. You know, like, or like for the German vaginas. What? Her father and her maternal grandfather was Jewish. Her mother was Protestant. She had two brothers, Walter and Alfred. Okay. So how she starts out in life, her mother, remember, was a suffragist. So at the 1916 National Democratic Convention in St. Louis, they did something called the Golden Lane, which was, it consisted of women carrying yellow parasols and wearing yellow sashes. They lined both sides of a main street that led to the Coliseum there. So a tableau of the states was in front of the art museum. The states that had not enfranchised women to vote, right, were draped in black. And in the front row were two little girls. One was a girl named Mary Taussig, and the other was Martha Gellhorn. And they represented the future voters.
Aww.
I think that's adorable, but I also think we need to do this for the states that pulled abortion rights. Okay.
Yeah, I'm ready. That part.
Yep. I'm going to stand in black and weep. Let's do it.
Y'all need to pay attention. Stay woke. That's where woke came from, people, because they will absolutely take away women's right to vote.
Yep. Yes. So let's do it now. Yeah.
Yep.
So. Fuck them all. What? I'm tired of this world sometimes.
All this would be solved if we went on, what is man murder? Listen, just round up. I'm dead serious.
I know you are.
Kinda. Round
Not
up
like,
all
really?
The pro- all the problematic And I don't mean like slightly problematic. I mean like abusers, like predators. Round those motherfuckers up, okay? And let's ship them off to an island. And let them have it.
There you go. We're not threatening murder. We're threatening what happened to Romeo? Where they sent him away? What is it?
Expulsion? When they excommunicate.
Excommunicate.
Yeah.
We are going to excommunicate to an awkward island with water that is not pretty. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, just put it. I mean, they can have a pretty island if they want. It won't be pretty for long because predators are going to predator. Yep.
All right. They're going to murder each other.
There would be a lot of peeing.
There would be a lot of peeing.
Maybe they'll be killed by a dolphin doing God's work.
Oh, that would be so nice.
Yeah.
I would enjoy that. So. All right. Let's keep going. okay. So... her father, I thought this was interesting. He pulled her out of her convent school. She was going to a convent school when he discovered that the nuns were teaching female anatomy with a textbook that had its pictures covered. So he couldn't, like, this is your female anatomy.
How cool are her parents, though? Like, her father's a gynecologist married to a suffragist. And then he's like, you need to be learning about stuff. No.
Like, how do you take care of your vagina if you don't know you have a vagina? Yeah. You know? I mean, where's the labia? Come on.
And then they expect girls to get married. That's why in Bridgerton, none of the girls are getting pregnant because they don't even know what to do. They don't know what real sex is.
Like, I don't know why I'm not pregnant.
Yeah. He touched me, so I should be pregnant.
I do. And then he held my hand.
Well, good on him, though. He was like, this is some bullshit.
Yeah. And you know what they did? They started a school. And she went to that school. Yeah.
Oh.
So her mother co-founded a new school.
To have parents like this, man. Wow.
Right? Right? So, okay. So then she, 1926, she graduated from John Burroughs School in St. Louis and enrolled in Bryn Mawr. In 1927, she left Bryn Mawr because she was like, I know everything. And she was a little bit right. So she went to pursue her career as a journalist.
Yeah, love this.
And she became a very well-renowned journalist. She first published articles in The New Republic, which was like a thing that my father used to read.
Oh.
So I'm like, okay. She then became a crime reporter for a local newspaper in Albany. So I'm guessing she's kind of moving where the jobs are. So Albany, right, is in New York. Then she got to Europe. She wanted to get to Europe. So what she did was she got to Europe by writing brochure for Holland America and traveled through the continent. So it was, you know, not so much crime reporting, right?
Yeah.
And then when she was there, she worked at the United Press Bureau in Paris. While she was working for that, she reported sexual harassment. And guess who got fired? Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, she obviously couldn't take the joke because they were just kidding.
Mm.
I mean, they also wanted to have sex with her.
And it's never some like hot dude, not to excuse sexual harassment, but you're never being sexually harassed by like some dude who looks like Matt Bomer or I don't know, Michael B. Jordan. It's usually some dude who looks like Steve Bannon.
Right?
Mm.
Yeah. And that's acting like you're really excited about the situation. Like, you should be. Like, no.
Yeah.
And this is why, like, I remember when, like, Anita Hill and sexual harassment or harassment, we remember those things. And there was this like, everyone, you know, it's awkward because now I have to watch what I say. Bitch, this is why. Also, watch what you say.
But also, do you know the amount of rioting that would happen if straight men were being harassed by gay men who were just making jokes?
Oh. Yeah,
the rioting that would happen.
Like, the amount of jails would fill.
Yeah.
Fill.
It's like, but they're just joking. What's the big
deal?
Just
kidding.
Why are you so sensitive?
Wrong? Yeah. I mean, you're cute. They do you, but.
Yeah.
Just like snowflakes.
It's a compliment.
Down. Yeah. You should take it as such. You should take it the way I want you to take it. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So she kept traveling Europe. She was writing papers in Paris and St. Louis. So she's just traveling back and forth. She also covered fashion for Vogue. And she became active in the pacifist movement. I like that. I'm a fan of that. And she wrote about her experiences in her book, What Mad Pursuit. So then later, she's just led the most amazing life. She met a man named Harry Hopkins, who was president. Have you heard of this president? Franklin D. Roosevelt?
Oh.
Vaguely.
FDR.
He was his confidant. And she talked her way into a job with the New Deal in 1932.
Wow. Yeah.
She worked for the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, or FERA. I wonder if it's FEMA. I wonder if that, I don't know. And she was a field investigator, and she wrote about the effects of depression on ordinary people. She was also very good friends with the First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who
I mean,
we love.
I mean, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Love her. Goddess, we need to do her one of these days.
Yes, absolutely.
And they invited her to live at the White House. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. So she was there for a little bit. She spent her evenings there assisting Eleanor with correspondence because she had, Eleanor had a My Day column in Women's Home Companion.
Yes,
and she helped her write it. Okay.
You know, it's so interesting too, because this would explain, because you know, she's my favorite first lady and Michelle Obama is my second favorite. No disrespect, but I think Michelle Obama would agree with me, actually. She's my favorite first lady because she really helped shape eventually what the New Deal could do. And the New Deal is the reason that it's basically the framework of modern American society. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because Martha had traveled around the world and different classes and different classes of people.
Yes.
And so seeing like really like what the world is really like versus like politicians who are always in, you know, buildings and homes, beautiful homes, and not really out with the people. But the New Deal was trying to get as much help to the regular people. And so advising Eleanor Roosevelt, like, I think that had an effect on Eleanor, who came from a Gilded Age family, like her husband. And so didn't really realize how normal people were living and suffering, but wanting to help, having that within her. And because of that, they were able to convince FDR, who at first the New Deal didn't cover Black people. I don't know if people know that, like, because he couldn't get it approved through Congress.
Say it again for the people in the back.
He couldn't get it approved through Congress because the Southern states were objecting to the New Deal programs being applied to certain Americans, actual Americans, Black Americans. And so that was the only way he could get it through, because they fought him on it. And he got it through, and through her efforts, Lady Eleanor Roosevelt started traveling around. Was like, she didn't know this, though, just to be clear. She didn't really know this.
Oh, she didn't. Oh, he did.
She didn't know this.
Okay.
And then she started talking, and she was like, well, we're like visiting Black neighborhoods. And they were like, yeah, we don't get it. And she's like, what? Like, no. So she started putting pressure on her husband. He was like, oh, I tried to, but I couldn't get it through Congress. And then she's like, well, we got to rectify that situation. So, and I think that comes from like who you surround yourself with. But during the New Deal, they used that money to make these sundown towns, these all white towns.
Shit.
So that's what I'm saying. It's the framework for a lot. And he just simply was like, well, we got to get money into the pockets, and we got to stimulate the economy, because people are suffering. Like, people are suffering. They need food. Like, we got to get the money somehow into the hands of these people, and so into the American public. And so that's what he was trying to do. But he's a rich dude. Both of them. He and Eleanor come from, like I said, Gilded Age family.
It does, I mean, it does kind of, it widens the awareness of what was happening, is that, you know, Martha was literally going.
Exactly.
She also, I was going to say this, but I'll talk about it now. She worked with Dorothea Lange, who was a photographer, a very famous photographer, mm-hmm. who documented everyday lives of the hungry and the homeless. So she was on the very front lines of everything that was happening.
So you should surround yourself with smart and kind people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really should.
Yeah.
And so these reports later became part of the official government files for the Great Depression. Which what's interesting is that they were able to investigate topics, I think both of them, Dorothea and her, that were not usually open to women in the 1930s. Mm. And then she wrote a collection of short stories based on this time, The Trouble I've Seen.
Mm.
Know that song? Published in 1936. Can't say that without thinking about that song.
Nobody knows.
Knows.
The Trouble I've Seen.
Can you go that low?
Nobody knows. No, I can't.
Damn, girl. Almost.
Nobody knows. That's because that's by Foghorn Leghorn. I say, boy.
I think I just pulled something trying to say sorrow. So this is Martha Gellhorn. So she's in Idaho. She's doing her FARA work, FERA, federal aid people, right? And she convinced a group of workers to break the windows of the FARA office there to draw attention to their crooked boss. And it worked. But also when she got fired from that job. Yeah. Okay. I think it was fine, but whatever.
Yeah. By any means necessary.
You know, got to get it done.
Yeah.
Girl had to get it done.
Yep.
So in 1930, we're going back a little bit. She had an affair with a French economist. Let's see if I can speak French. Ready? Bertrand de Jouvenel. That's pretty good.
That sounds good to me. Better than me.
Oh, yes. Yes, I know.
Okay. I'd be like Bertrand Duva. Duvenal?
Don't do that.
Duval?
Absolutely not.
But you had to use the accent in the Duvazoo. It's very sexy.
Now I think you're in Italy. All right. So she was 22. Their affair lasted for 4 years. And she would have married him had he not
been married.
Yeah.
That's very French, I think.
That's what happened. I read another source that said she did marry him. But
who knows?
Yeah. This is where I'm like, nyeh. So when she was 1934, she was among a group of American students that were invited, and she wasn't a student, but she was a group of them. She was invited as well to tour Nazi Germany. And this account with fascism was very inspiring to her in her later career. We'll talk more about that. She was basically like, no, that's bad. So just
she's
so you know
horrified.
Which way she falls on the notorious level. She was like, Nazis bad, which is good. Right. We like that. In 1936, she was on a Christmas family trip to Key West where she met a Mr. Ernest Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now,
was he still sexy and young or was he like old?
Nah, he's cute.
Okay.
He is cute. So, I mean, I don't want to tell you about her sex life, but I think they probably had sex. they agreed to travel to Spain together because she had been hired by Collier's Weekly to cover the Spanish Civil War. And, they were there. They celebrated Christmas together in 1937 in Barcelona. And then from Germany, she reported up on the rise of Adolf Hitler. She didn't, because I reading about this, I'm like, girl, you're half Jewish. Like, you can't be in Europe right now.
What does she look like, though?
She looks like a white girl who's not Jewish. But
okay, yeah,
they didn't care. They had records that you could look like whatever.
Yeah,
it wasn't. That's the weird thing people don't talk about. Like, if you were, you know, the one drop rule in America.
Yeah.
The same thing. It was like people who didn't know they were Jewish, you know, not, or people who had a grandpa somewhere. They didn't think about it.
Yeah.
Suddenly they were Jewish.
But was she blonde?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, there's a part of it that
can hide a little. Yeah. And American.
So
they don't have those records, right?
Yeah.
So, but in the spring of 1938,
and she has a German last name too.
Yes.
So did
all of the Jews in Germany.
No, but I'm thinking she, in her head, in her American head, that's what she's thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
So she was in Czechoslovakia and she wrote a book about being in Czechoslovakia during the outbreak of World War II called A Stricken Field. And then she later reported the war from Finland, Hong Kong, Burma, Singapore, and England. So she was kind of out of the line of fire, except for when she went to England. And she went to England to report on the Blitz. Ooh. She was the bravest human. So she didn't have official press credentials to witness the Normandy landings. So what she did was she hid in a hospital ship bathroom. When the ship landed, she impersonated a stretcher bearer and got away with it. She quote her, "I followed the war wherever I could reach it."
Have they not made like a
movie
or series? Like
a series
of her solving crimes?
This shit is real. It really happened. And I love Murdoch, but none of that actually happened. You know what I'm saying?
It's like, you're welcome. You're welcome, whoever's listening. This is like real money, money, money. Like, just make a series. Telling you.
She hit. And my mother would kill me. Kill me. Hell no. Go home. She'd be like, "I bought your plane ticket. Get on the plane."
Yeah. My Lord. Wow.
All right. So she was, P.S., the only woman to land at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th, 1944. She was also among the first journalists to report from Dachau concentration camp after it was liberated April 29th, 1945. Wow. So badass. She went to where things were happening, and some of her writings were like, what she saw was horrifying.
Yeah.
And like she quote her, "The kind of thing I hope no one ever witnesses." But I thought that was really fascinating that, but for her, she needed to be the one to witness and report on it everywhere for everything. You'll see more. She goes everywhere.
I bet you her hero was Nellie Bly.
Yeah.
You know, this is why role models are important, because as the next generation comes along, they're like, "Oh, I want to do something like that." But then they forge their own path, you know? So.
Right. No, but it's really fascinating to me to read about someone like her, because I am the complete opposite.
I'm going away from the murder, death, and war. No, I'm not going towards it. But
absolutely not. But we need these heroes. Yep. We need these people. We need that kind.
The press is important. Yep.
Yeah. Really important. So let's talk about her and Hemingway for a minute. They were together on and off for 4 years. December 1940, they get married. So Hemingway was still with his wife until 1939, but somehow they were still together for 4 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, she was his mistress. I feel like people did that a lot back then. It was like an open secret.
Yeah, I think so, too. I really think so, too. So he started getting more and more resentful about her long absences, because they're married now, right?
Because she had a life.
He wrote her, when she left to cover the Italian front in 1943, because there was still a war happening. He says, quote, "Are you a war correspondent or wife in my bed?" I mean, I think the answer is war correspondent. Thank you for asking.
Dude, you knew she was like this before you married her.
Right.
Like, so now you want to domesticate her.
Now you want all that fire and intelligence and what am I saying? Like, just, you know.
What attracted you? The attraction, the excitement. Yeah. You want to tamp it down.
That's That's brave. That brave, that whip smart, that focused. She's not going to stay a wife in your bed, bitch.
Okay? Yeah, the bed part is the thing that really gets me. Because I get you want your spouse to be with you. I get that. But wife in my bed. Like,
wife, I would like to fuck all the time when I feel like it. That's what I read like, when I read that.
When I'm ready.
Right.
Because my work is more important. So,
P.S. Yeah. So, like, she also had an affair with a U.S. paratrooper, Major General James M. Gavin, whilst they were married.
Of course she did.
Because she was pissed. Right?
And that guy sounds hot. I'm just saying.
Doesn't he, though? That's why I said U.S. Paratrooper Major General James M. Gavin. Hello, James.
Hello.
Okay.
I have a saying when I see somebody I think is cute. It goes like, hey, what's your name, yells? And then I become the lady in the tramp dog. Hey, what's your name, yells?
Oh my God, you're so cute. I would talk to you. I'd be like, I'm Miriam. I'm very straight though. But if I weren't, okay.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So Hemingway also would go to the front just before the Normandy landings. And he tried to block her travel. So when she arrived back to London by means of a dangerous ocean voyage instead of where she was supposed to go, she divorced his ass. Bye.
Good for her. Good riddance. Like, he's actively trying to become an albatross around her neck.
Yes.
Wow.
And she, for the rest of her life, got apparently like volatile and really fucking angry every time they wanted to ask about her relationship with Hemingway.
And she had said,
I don't want to be a footnote in his life.
Yeah.
And she's not like, oh my God.
I would have been like, let me tell you about this limp dick motherfucker. This is what happened. And they'd be like, they'll never ask me again.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Any more questions? The sex was average at best.
Yes. It's like, no, I'd be like, no, because you always have to play up how bad it was, right? Even if at the time you're like, I love him or whatever. But it's like, he was a terrible lay. That's why I had an affair with sexy, what's his name? Colonel James.
James M. Gavin. Yes. James. Yes.
Hi, what's your name, yo?
So then she is still traveling, is still on fronts of many things. She's also has romantic entanglements with L. Lawrence Rockefeller, a journalist named William Walter, and a doctor named David Gerwich. And then she married the former managing editor of Time magazine, T.S. Matthews, in 1954, and they divorced in 1963. It's interesting. She talks about sex and how I think it's interesting that she wasn't that into sex so much. This is a quote from her. I just want to talk about it because I think it's really interesting that she says, quote, in bed was the only time I was ever passive. She computed that 90% of her sexual life had been a waste of time. She essentially agreed to have sex because the men needed it to keep connected.
So not much has changed for many women.
I mean, it makes you, I just think it should be talked about because I think that we don't honor women's pleasure. She probably never had sex with a man who knew what to do.
That part. Yeah. That part. Yeah.
She called herself, she was like the Florence Nightingale, because sometimes she would have sex with someone like when they were about to go off to war. She'd be like, okay.
I love how straightforward she is about this. She was like, most of them were bad, but you know.
I mean,
it is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
So in 1949, she adopted a boy, Sandy, from an Italian orphanage. Now, she hadn't really wanted to be a mother, but the war from what I read, definitely affected sort of her humanity and her view on humanity. Remember, she saw Dachau at the end. She's been, you know, D-Day and the troops and all of that, right? Like, she's seen some horrors.
And many children, beautiful children.
Yes.
Without parents. Yeah.
And because of the war, there are, and I think, hashtag not historians, I think she felt like she had the money and resources to at least help this one child. And so there's conflicting thoughts on, essentially what we do know, that she was very maternal with him for a while and then ended up leaving him in the care of relatives in Englewood, New Jersey for long periods of time. And that he eventually went to boarding school, and their relationship was, one source called it embittered, but you know, he, as a grown up, said, no, I love her and I'm grateful for her, and y'all don't understand the situation. And my guess is she did what she did and realized she couldn't, women those days could not be both. So I think there was a lot of judgment.
Yeah.
In her situation, she was going to leave her child at home to go do her job because it wasn't safe to bring her child, which plenty of dads have to travel for work. It's not a conversation. They just go.
Yeah.
So that's what this was.
She and I have this in common. Like I said, when I was like 12, I was like, I'm never having children. And then I got a little bit old, and then you hit like, you know, your 20s and you're like, oh, I'm in love. Yeah, we'll probably have a baby, get married, whatever. But honestly, I'm very maternal. Like, I'm very nurturing.
You are very nurturing.
But I think children are so special that they need to be planned for and cared for. And it's to do it right. Because even wonderful parents like yourself, it's a lot of work and you get tired. And you really have to always put the kids first, particularly when they're very young. And I would imagine he was in an orphanage, so he lost his parents. Then he has this wonderful woman come, and then she goes off. As a child, he feels abandoned again, even though she's leaving him in the care of her family. And then as he became an adult and realized, like, oh, adults have different responsibilities.
Yeah.
It's not that she didn't love me. And then so as you get older, you become a little bit more mature. But I totally, this sounds like something that would have happened to me, like, if I had her job, like, because children need... they need your care. They need your attention.
They do.
And I take motherhood very seriously. So
who knows if she talked to her family and said, hey, I want to do this. I have a job that requires me to travel to dangerous places.
Yeah. Cause parents,
but you've not seen Europe. It's really horrifying. It's very sad. And they might've been like, yeah, adopt. Well, but you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot we don't
know.
Also,
I mean, it's a kid. And so, like, usually, especially back then, they're like, oh, we're all going to surround this kid with love. Don't worry. He's going to be fine. Like,
right.
You know, and then if she had the resources to, because that's a thing. It's one thing to take on a kid with when you ain't got no money, because you can love the kid all you want, but the kids need things. Okay. Like medicine and doctor's visits.
Are you telling me?
I'm just saying.
Things I know too well.
As well as food, clothes, shelter.
They don't stop eating.
Safety.
I'm telling you.
Oh, wait till they become teenagers.
No.
Especially
not
your boy. You're going
to
start inhaling food, girl.
It's not good. No.
Ooh.
I can't afford them.
Yeah.
Should we grow a garden of cows? I mean.
He's going to be eating so much. You're like, I don't understand. They don't even understand at that age. Like, they're just inhaling food.
I have a friend, total side note. We were in our 20s, maybe early 30s, and he wanted to start running again. And I was helping him. And he's like, I don't understand. When I was 16, and he told me his McDonald's order, it was like 3 cheeseburgers, a Big Mac, fries, and a large Coke. And I was so skinny. And I was like, how old were you again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what that was.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not though that anymore.
No.
So.
No.
All right. Okay. So She is now working for the Atlantic Monthly. She's now covering the Vietnam War. This is the 60s and the 70s, the Arab-Israeli conflicts. In 1979, she turned 70, and she kept working. She covered the civil wars in Central America. As she approached 80, she began to slow down, although she still managed to cover the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. And she finally retired from journalism in the 1990s. So she had an operation for cataracts, which was unsuccessful and left her with impaired vision. It wasn't gone, but it was impaired. So then she announced that she was too old to cover the Balkan conflicts in the 90s. She did one more overseas trip to Brazil to cover poverty in that country. And it was published in the literary journal Granta. She couldn't read her own manuscripts, but she published them. So she had a couple of more books that she talked called The Face of War in 1959. And then she wrote a novel called The Lowest Trees Have Tops in 1967 about McCarthyism. I should note that she's been accused of being liberal. But I love her response to that. It's very much like, I write what I see. I can't tell you the other side of that. I'm here to tell you what I see. And that's journalism. And the, and she says, she's like, I'm not, if I think it's bad, I'll tell you I think it's bad. And that makes her badass. Wow. So in her last years, she's very old. She was almost blind and she had ovarian cancer that had spread to her liver. So on February 15th, 1998, she swallowed a cyanide pill to end her life early. On her own terms. She lived her life on her own terms.
Martha is gangster. I did not see that coming.
Right?
She was like, yeah, we're not doing this the slow way. Fuck you, life. Fuck you, death. Come
Thank you.
Me.
I'm done now.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's gangster.
Right. So that is Martha Gellhorn.
Excuse me. I did not see that coming. I'm just like, oh. I mean, you know, I like a gangster woman.
I love her. And she, like, for all intents and purposes, like, she was a huge personality. People were intimidated by her. She did not. I mean, I would be terrified of her.
She and I could be friends because I like a woman that makes people scared. So
I know,
you know, but who's also kind, who's like, well, yeah, I'm going to make the asshole scared. But
she came, she had her very strong convictions and you could disagree, but she was going to eat you alive.
Yeah. And she's rooting for the underdog. So that's my kind of lady. Yeah. What a well-lived life. Wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that with me.
You're very welcome.
Now, I know that I told you I was going to cover a certain kind of woman. And she actually would have been a good companion for Martha. But I decided to like change course because I realized I looked at the calendar. And I was like, oh, this is going to come out in June. And June is Black Music History Month.
Oh.
So, I decided, I was like, oh, let me find somebody that would be good. There's so many because Black people, we make good music. I'm just saying, unless we've known to do that. So there's a lot of people to choose from. But, you know, again, I like a strong woman like Martha. And so I was like, let's start off the month right. So my notorious woman this week is Lisa Left Eye Lopez.
Yes! Oh my God. Can I tell you how many times I have almost covered her? Can I tell you? She has been in my head. I guess I'm not doing it.
Well, I'm glad I beat you to it because she's a good one. Now, I'm going to try. There's a lot going on. There's a lot. She, in her short life, she actually produce a lot of stuff. She's really great. So a lot of this is going to be the highlights, but there's also more information. But also with the whole like Diddy, Cassie, maybe hip hop, maybe the music industry is finally getting in their comeuppance. We'll see. But so I was like, who can I do that's kind of like in that theme of, what's going on in the music industry currently?
Yeah.
Lisa Left Eye Lopez was born Lisa Nicole Lopez on May 27th, 1971 in Philadelphia to Wanda Denise, now Wanda Lopez Coleman, a seamstress, and Ronald Lopez Sr., a U.S. staff sergeant.
Okay.
Now, she's the oldest of three children, and she has a younger brother, Ronald Jr., and a younger sister, Rain, nicknamed Raindrop. Growing up, Lisa said of her father, he was very strict and very domineering, and that he treated the family sometimes like they were in boot camp. And she recalled a time, and this is a documentary that was released after her death that she was actually shooting at the time of her death. So in this documentary, she talks about how one time he came home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he would get them all out of bed, and they'd have to go downstairs and line up.
Why?
They were in boot camp. And he'd be like, now, how many times did you guys walk past this pen that's on the floor? It's like, they're kids. They throw things on the floor, dude. So
listen,
he was
as a parent,
he's just,
I don't want to say I get it because that's abusive.
Yeah. I mean,
but
you
but do it in the morning. Do it.
Not 3 a.m. and wake them out of bed. 3
a.m., pick up the pen, put it away.
Yeah.
Next time you see it during the day, be like, hey.
Excuse me. Hey. But also, it's kids. They're not going to be as clean and tidy as you expect.
They're not.
Army recruits.
Yeah.
I'm not
as clean and tidy as he would want me to be. So
no. So, but like her, her father was a talented musician who actually played the harmonica, clarinet, piano, and saxophone. In the doc, she also talks about how growing up, she realized that everybody on her mother's side were artistically inclined and everybody on her dad's side was musically inclined.
Oh, interesting.
Her paternal grandfather even performed regularly at the Cotton Club and the Savoy. So she comes from really creative pedigree. So now, when she was very young, she said basically her parents were together for about 12 years when they separated. Initially, her mom took her and her siblings away and they lived with her. But, being a single mother at that time, who knows how much, it's just very, very hard. And I suspect that her father probably was harassing her mother after, because a man like that is probably harassing you. So at some point, her and her siblings got split up. And she went to live with her paternal grandmother with her father nearby.
Okay.
And according to her, her paternal grandmother was a bit of a bully. Basically, she described the situation as a mommy dearest situation.
Oh,
like having to hide like she would hide like the iron, and they'd go to school with wrinkled clothes on. Like she was just, I don't understand people who treat children like this. And she even said that her grandmother once told her that the church clothes that she bought her were still hers because she paid for them.
Oh, my
God.
So
she was basically just borrowing the clothes. And that she also said she bought those clothes because when she went to church was the only time that she looked good and looked put together, because those were her church clothes. So they were nicer than the other stuff. Now, when she was young, she says that she was running by at 7 months. So she, according to her, she was very advanced, like just a very advanced child. But she was always very independent and musically inclined, again, her pedigree.
Yeah.
So by age 5, she was already playing on a toy piano and composing little songs.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And when she was 10, she formed a musical trio with her siblings, and they called themselves the Lopez Kids. And they would perform gospel songs at local events and churches. Oh. And basically she got the performing bug,
Yeah.
So she was just very vivacious and outgoing. But she said everything also changed for her musically when she heard Queen Latifah and Moni Love's song Ladies First.
Yes.
Ooh, Lady ladies first. You guys should check it out. It's a really good song. So she was like, yo, I want to do that. So then she got into hip hop and rapping. So that like was added to her like musical taste and performance. So basically she performed everywhere she could. She was just like, I'm out there. I have big dreams. I'm going to get stuff done. And like, you know,
that's which amazing.
Which was really, really important. So after she was living with her grandmother, you know, she still had that inner, but she was just trying to basically navigate because her father was still around. So he was still very strict. And which was so weird because she said that he was very controlling and strict. And then she lived with her grandmother. But the only thing he wasn't controlling and strict in was with drinking alcohol.
What?
And he would often drink with her.
What?
Yeah, it's very odd. She said that he was
as a child,
You know, young teenager now, like tweens, teens. So she said he would come over like she's like 15. He would come over and see her, and he'd bring like a case of beer, and they'd drink it together.
Okay.
So by age 16,
like wake up, you didn't pick up this pen, but have a beer with me. No.
And her father, as you can might guess, he battled alcoholism as
well. Yeah.
So according to her, by age 16, her tolerance for alcohol was so high. She was just, and then her father would just be egging her on like, there she goes. So then she also felt like it was a way to get attention, positive attention from him.
Yeah.
So, but then, you know, back and forth with her grandmother. So she ran away a couple times, you know, because her grandmother sounds like a monster. I just don't understand people.
And
doing
her
this
mom
to kids.
Couldn't.
Her mom was, you know, just trying to do the best that she could with some of her siblings and just like make it away. And then again, having known like these kinds of situations and observed them, oftentimes the men who are controlling and then have an alcohol problem, they're constantly harassing their exes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So who knows? He, you know, she probably is out of state because he probably shows up to her job, causing problems, getting her fired, all kinds of stuff. A lot of like, you know, I'm sure there's a reason why the children had to be separated because perhaps one relative couldn't take more than one. But basically her grandmother, like she said, like her, like they couldn't wash their hair. She couldn't wash her hair because her grandmother would be upset that the water bill was too high. Like that kind of thing.
Oh, come on, grandma.
And it's like their kid, like. Yeah. Anyway,
also they need to wash themselves.
Yeah, that's especially at that age. All of them are funky. So
I know.
Yeah. So, but at age 17, she finally moved out for good because she was like, I just gotta, you know, I gotta get out of here because before she went to live with her grandmother, her grades were pretty high because she's a very intelligent girl. But all of that stress of that, her grades started to suffer. She started to act out, and then her father would come in and discipline. So it was just a bad situation.
Discipline and give her a beer.
So it's like mixed signals. A lot's going on. So she decided to move out finally at 17, and she actually ended up in Atlanta. She moved there initially to dance in a music video, and she just began making the rounds because she wanted to get in the music industry. And just for context, Atlanta had blown up like around this time musically. It had become mainly because, you know, a couple big time producers decided to make Atlanta their new home because, you know, New York was already saturated. L.A. was already saturated. And so particularly L.A. and Babyface, they came out. And they decided, oh, there's a lot of talent here, untapped talent here. And so that's when Atlanta became like a big, was beginning to be like a big, like a place to be for music.
Okay.
And so she moved there, and it's also, I'm sure, probably cheaper than Philly at the time. And so in 1991, so she's about 1920, she met Teyon Watkins, a.k.a. T-Boz, at an open audition for an R&B girl group. They eventually were signed to a deal by Perry Pebbles Reed, L.A. Reed's wife. A former artist turned producer and manager when she put them together in a group with a third girl called TLC. Now, just for context, so Pebbles has a song, Girlfriend. Couldn't let it treat you so bad. To believe, not to believe. Anyway, so she was already an artist. And again, L.A. Reid and Babyface were already established along with Pebbles because Pebbles contributed a lot to LaFace Records. It became LaFace Records.
Yes.
And she decided she wanted to get into management because you don't have a lot of control as an artist. So
right.
she put them together. And originally it was Lisa T. Boz and a girl named Crystal Jones.
Okay.
So T for Tion, right. Lisa Lopez, and then Crystal
TLC.
For C. Things didn't work out with Crystal. So Pebbles brought in a backup dancer for an artist, Damian Dame, by the name of Rosanda Thomas.
Okay.
And so they were like, well, we need to come up with something that replaces the C. So they came up with Chili, which is a name that Lisa
there
came
you
up
go.
With. So
yep. okay.
TLC was complete. T-Boz was given that name, slang for boss, because by all accounts, her voice was so deep. Because she talked like this, but her voice was really deep. She had a
oh,
very
really?
distinctive sound, which really allowed them as a girl group to really distinguish themselves.
Yes.
And so they gave her, you know, it's slang for boss. So T-Boz, like T-Boz.
Okay.
And then Left Eye came from basically... It's rumored that Michael Bivins from New Edition said that he thought her left eye was more attractive than her right eye or something. So
you can do that.
Yeah, I know. So they came up with that. So I think it's very cute. So that's what they came up with. And then she later on came up with the idea when they played around. Like she was like the one that was like really playing around, like with the condoms and putting it over her right eye. And like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, like play it up, you know, because you got to have a gimmick, right?
Get a gimmick.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that is a thing that they came up with. You know, so they from the start, they were like, it was like perfect timing, because not only did they have great chemistry,
they did,
especially
yes.
when Chili came in, like they had chemistry off the wazoo. They all were very talented and they were all very ambitious. Like they really, really
yeah.
wanted it to work. So she said that things went really, really fast. So she moves 90. She moves to Atlanta. 92. The group's debut album comes out called Ooh on the TLC Tip. And out of the gate, they were a hit.
From yes.
their first single, Ain't Too Proud to Beg, which
nope.
ain't too
nope.
proud to beg. Even in the morning, in the middle of the night, I ain't too proud
too
to beg. Yeah.
To beg.
So it was a hit.
Listen to it all the time.
Like they were a juggernaut. Like they came out, and also because they had the baggy clothes, so they weren't over sexualized like a lot of girl groups. They were like really
right.
cool. And then they like promoted like say sex, and like it was just like really, really great. And a lot of that goes to not only them, but also Pebbles. Pebbles is a great manager. So,
yeah.
So that album, again, 90, she moves to Atlanta.
That's
92,
crazy.
The album comes out, juggernaut. They had four hit singles and it sold over 6 million copies.
It was so good.
So good. Now, shortly after that was released, she began dating a football player by the name of Andre Rison. And the two
okay.
soon moved in together. So, you know, in his upscale double story home, you know, so she's like living the life. All her dreams are coming true. She's got this sexy superstar football boyfriend, you know.
Okay.
Now, their relationship was allegedly filled with a lot of violent moments. Mm-hmm. And she filed assault charges against him in September of 1993.
Okay.
They had now, again, her battle with alcohol. Again, it started when it goes back to when she's like 15. So she says that that's what contributed to on the morning of June 9th, 1994. They got into a fight. So she started just going around the house and just burning all his shit. She's like, fuck you. I'm gonna kick all your shit. I'm getting all. Blah, blah, blah. So she started like throwing his shit around. And then she put a bunch of his like tennis shoes, kicks,
yeah.
Jordans, whatever they are. Very expensive.
The good ones. Yeah.
Yeah. In the bathtub and lit them on fire.
Oh, my God.
This is my fucking kind of girl. Women got a lot of rage.
Yeah.
But the fiberglass bathtub quickly melted and set the structural frame of the house on fire.
Oops.
She was eventually arrested and indicted on charges of first degree arson. And then eventually sentenced to 5 years of probation and a $10,000 fine. Mainly because Rison, he really didn't want to press charges, but I mean... The house burned down. And then
she did burn down his house.
She burned down his house.
But he shouldn't I don't know.
It was all on the news and like, and they're both really famous and, you know, but afterwards they reconciled and actually got back together and continued an on and off relationship for 7 years. This is ghetto loving. I've never been a fan of this. No, like after that, but this is why therapy is important. Okay?
Therapy is very important. This is not a healthy relationship.
Yeah. Now at the time of the incident, she said that he had beaten her after a night out. So she set fire to his shoes and burned down the house. She said it was an accident. She really didn't mean to burn down the house. Like,
right.
So she better me because I've been like, burn, baby, burn. But that's just me because I'm a trifling bitch. But anyway, she later clarified that she was upset because she had seen, and even in interviews he's done, that she had caught him. She accused him of cheating because she came to the house and there were a bunch of women there. You know, he's a football player. He's handsome.
Then he's cheating on you.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's probably true.
But she later clarified that she didn't feel like she had a lot of freedom within the relationship and that he did indeed abuse her emotionally and physically, which is something that her father was accused of with her mother when she was growing up. So she said she released her frustrations about the relationship that night with, you know, setting his stuff on fire. Now, in the documentary that, again, it was released shortly after her death, that actually in the documentary, you actually see her die, basically. She said that when she drank, her alter ego called Nikki would show up. And people often said that she indeed became a different person other than Lisa, who was very sweet, outgoing. When she drank, she turned into another person. So she said that. Because of that, Nikki and Lisa would battle it out sometimes. So she created a third ego, alter ego called Nina, who she said was her evil twin that would come in and straighten things out too. In this documentary, she's still, you know, quite young and still just sort of starting on her like spiritual journey in a lot of ways. So, but I do feel like at this time, she's like in her early 20s when this is happening.
Yeah.
And she's full on an alcoholic by her own admission. And so she's just trying to make sense of all this stuff that's happening. So, but I just thought that was interesting because I don't know. It sounds like Nikki burned his shit. So,
yeah, I don't think she did anything.
I think it was Nikki. And I'm not really sorry, but I do think they probably should have separated shortly after that. But who knows?
They should
on
have
and off for another
separated,
7 years.
And she should have seen a very good psychiatrist because she's like clearly have trauma. She needs to work through.
And
I know
clearly,
because I watch like a lot of television and that's usually what happens. And
also,
I watched it.
Keep in mind, like she's young and then like became like successful really, really quickly. So has eyes on her. And because a lot of stuff comes with this kind of fame other than like you get to live out your creative dreams. But then if you're also, these are very young people who, you know, are in love. So she doesn't even have a role model for it or a successful, healthy relationship at this point. So she's just probably thinking
that she doesn't have, even if she didn't have a role model of a healthy relationship, if she had some stability outside and before this relationship, she would have understood what's, if her grandmother was not horrible, right? If she was sent to live with grandma and grandma was like, I got you. I see what's going on. I'm here for you. Here's what you're worth. But nobody ever told her what she was worth.
Yeah, or somebody
even though
to
she
call.
Knew it in her, she knew it in herself, but
to
you got
to like,
be told.
Grandma, like, he did this. And she's like, baby, no, you need to leave that boy. You don't need to put up with that. You're beautiful, da, da, da. But a lot of people get in this cycle, particularly at this age. So they moved on and she actually went to rehab.
So
despite her personal setbacks, the group flourished. Their second album, Crazy Sexy Cool, was even more successful than the first album.
And it was even better.
It was even better. It was. It eventually sold 23 million copies.
You're welcome.
But because of her, she was in rehab during the making when they were recording this and putting this together. She had limited input in the writing and the recording of the album, which it would foreshadow her growing frustration with wanting to do more personal music that she could contribute to. But again, right. It was a juggernaut. It was a huge hit. After the release of Crazy Sexy Cool, she began branching out a little bit more. She recorded a song with Keith Sweat, who was we lovingly call him Keith Sweat, Keith with an F, Sweat, in 1994, called How Do You Like It? She also went on to be featured as a solo artist on other projects, including ones with Queen Latifah.
Yes.
MC Light, Patra, the dance hall queen. Patra, love Patra. Yo-Yo, Salt and Pepper, Lil' Kim, Missy Elliott, and Da Brat. So, that, and that song with Lil' Kim, Missy, and Da Brat actually was nominated for a bunch of awards, as well as with her work with TLC. So huge. Like, all her dreams are coming true. The first album was great. The second album's even better. And like, you know, they got a glam squad. And so, though Crazy Sexy Cool was a massive hit after the first one was a massive hit, according to Lisa and the other group members, T-Boz and Chili, they didn't see a lot of the money from the sale.
I believe that.
So they were frustrated because they're like, my dreams are coming true, but I'm still driving like a Nissan Sentra, like, or equivalent of it. Like, where the money at? You know, show me the money. So in 1994, they sued their manager, Pebbles, for mismanaging funds and paying them, according to them, $50,000 each in 1993 and 94.
That's insane.
Yeah. So they were like, we're going to file for bankruptcy and we're going to file for bankruptcy. And we're also going to sue you because there's no way in hell that's all we should be getting.
Listen, for what they're doing, like that in the 90s, that's not even a great job.
No.
That's
at this point,
a crappy job.
It has sold at least 10 million records. So they're like,
hell no.
Like, what is going on? Yeah, we know that, you know, oftentimes in these contracts, they're given like advances and they have to pay back. And but this record had sold already 10 million copies.
Yeah. Where's their money?
Where's the fucking money? And at this time, like, CDs were like anywhere from $11 to $16.
Yeah, they were like, and the new CDs were $16. Like, that was $15.99.
Okay. So where the money at? So they took her to court, and after over a year long battle, they settled the settlement included a confidentiality clause barring comment on the financial details or other specifics of the agreement. Two of the lawyers who helped broker the agreement said it provided for a direct recording contract between the trio, Lisa, Tion, and Rosanda, and the recording label LaFace for an undisclosed amount of albums. It also released them from contractual obligations with Pebbystone, so Pebbles Management Group. Yeah. They had been waiting on the federal bankruptcy court to rule over whether they could use the filing of bankruptcy to get out of their contract. Because basically they were like, this is a terrible contract. Right. So this is a way for us to, we can't cover our bills, but also for us to break the contract. So the bankruptcy filing was upheld in April of that year, despite vigorous opposition from LaFace and Pebbles. Yeah. So I kind of glossed over that, but that's a very complicated thing. But and I know Pebbles was like, I didn't rip you off, because I think Pebbles was like, you guys are accusing me of being a crook. And it's like, no, all they're saying is that we've sold over 20 million records for two of our records, and we've gotten $100,000 each.
That doesn't make any sense.
No.
Especially because, like, honestly, like, I feel like that's a lot of money. It's not. It's all the money they're making. And to be this level celebrity requires a whole shit ton of money. Like, you have to put a lot into yourself and what you do and where you go. And that's going to cost.
Yeah.
And also they're earning it.
And also
earning it. It's their money.
It's their money. So So they settled that. And then in 1999, I'm going to try and just get through this because I don't want it to be too long. But in 1999, their third album, Fan Mail, which is one of my favorite, was released and sold over 14 million copies worldwide.
Oh, my God. They're just
now,
killing
during,
it.
Yeah. During and after the release of Fan Mail, her creative frustrations became more public. So she felt basically her contributions to songs had been reduced to a periodic 8-bar rap. And there were several songs in which she had no vocals. So a May issue of Vibe magazine, she had said, quote, "I've graduated from this era. I cannot stand 100% behind this TLC project and the music that is supposed to represent me," end quote. Okay. Now, in response to this interview, T-Boz and Chili reached out to Entertainment Weekly that said, quote, "Lisa doesn't respect the whole group," end quote. And then they went on to say that, quote, "Left Eye is only concerned with Left Eye," end quote. Now, in response, Lisa replied through the Entertainment Weekly thing, issuing a challenge to her, saying, quote, "I challenge Teyon Watkins and Rosanda Thomas to an album entitled The Challenge, a 3-CD set that contains 3 solo albums. Each album will be due to the record label by October 1st, 2000. I also challenged Dallas the Manipulator because he was their main producer on their material. Okay. And famously, he and Chili started dating and actually had a son together.
Okay.
So to produce all the material and do it at a fraction of his normal rate, as I think about it, I'm sure LaFace would not mind throwing in $1.5 million prize for the winner. End quote.
Okay.
So she was just like being like an agitator, like, again, very young. And she's just very frustrated, and maturity comes, you know how to communicate these things to people. And right. I'm sure, and at this point, they're all sisters. So it's like you're fighting with your sister, and they're like,
yeah,
girl.
Yeah, I was going to say, like.
Like, they were like, girl, bye. Ain't nobody doing this. So.
Yeah.
So they would shade each other publicly back and forth. But again, they were like sisters. So. And then eventually they addressed the issue, the struggles, and they were saying, we're very much like sisters who have disagreements every now and then. Yeah. And then Lisa herself even said, quote, "It's deeper than a working relationship. We have feelings for each other, which is why we get so mad at each other."
Yeah.
"I usually say that you cannot hate someone unless you love them. So we love each other. That's the problem." End quote. So she basically was just very frustrated. And she would do things like in September of that year, she was reported missing because she failed to attend a family gathering and a major press conference in Las Vegas. So
I think I remember this.
Yeah. So it's just like, and who knows? She's battling probably, who knows if she fell off the wagon, just a lot of stuff, just sort of typical young people with money acting out. Now, despite all of this, the Fan Mail album and the tour, because they had a tour, was extremely successful. So, and I think that's also because they're starting to make money off of the tour and with the new contract. So they're actually starting to make the money that they deserve as like superstars.
Yes. Good.
But yeah. So after that rap, she began recording her debut solo album, Supernova. And it included a song called entitled A New Star Is Born, which was dedicated to her father and another duet with Tupac Shakur, who had passed at that time. Tupac like recorded like 100 songs, it seems. And so it was part of a bunch of songs that he had recorded, and they had a duet on. But again, by that time he had passed. So she wanted to pull some of that and put it on her solo album.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Now the scheduled release date of it was the 11th anniversary of her grandfather's death. But Arista Records decided to delay it. And they canceled the American release of it. The album would eventually be released in August of 2001 in different foreign countries. So
why?
I don't know. It's who knows what goes on in these record companies. A lot of bad. Yeah. Now, pissed at this move that Arista did, after that, she began having numerous talks with Death Row Records and CEO Suge Knight. So she severed her solo deal with Arista, and she only, because she was still on their label with the group as TLC. But she signed as a solo artist tonight to Death Row Records in January of 2002. Intending to record her second solo album under the name, the pseudonym Nina.
Oh.
Which is new identity, not applicable. So, which she hoped would include collaborations with David Bowie and Missy Elliott.
Okay.
Now, but on April 25th in 2002, so a couple months later, while visiting Honduras, she was in the process of setting up two educational centers for Honduran children as part of her charitable work. She was driving a rented Mitsubishi Montero SUV in La Ceiba. I think that's how you say it. Ceiba, Honduras, when she swerved to avoid a truck, then sharply to the left as she tried to avoid an oncoming car. The vehicle rolled over several times after hitting two trees, throwing her and three others out of the windows, and finally coming to rest in a ditch at the side of the road, killing Lisa Left Eye Lopez, who was only 30 years old at the time. Now, according to reports, she died instantly, hopefully. And she was the only person fatally injured in the crash because she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. Yeah. And remember that documentary I keep mentioning it? She was recording it as herself. It was like a 30-day retreat, a spiritual retreat. And this was like the 27th day.
Oh my God.
They were actually recording when the accident happened.
I couldn't bring myself
to watch it because it was just so upsetting and so she passed as a result of that crash on April 25th, 2002. Roughly 2 weeks before her death, she was a passenger in a traffic accident that resulted in the death of a 10-year-old Honduran boy. She reportedly was so upset at the tragedy, so she paid for the medical bills because he was rushed to the hospital and then later died. But she paid for the hospital bills to lighten the load on the family. And in this documentary that was released after her death, which was part of this recording, it's called The Last Days of Left Eye. She's shown choosing a casket for the little boy and from a local funeral home. Earlier in the documentary, she talked about the death of the kid, and she said that she felt, she mentions that she felt the presence, quote, of a spirit following her and a spirit, unquote, quote, unquote, following her. And she was struck by the fact that the child was killed in the accident, shared a similar last name as her. So she thought that she was being stalked by the spirit who had made a mistake by killing the boy instead of her.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really ominous and very upsetting.
Yeah.
Now, her funeral was held at New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Lithonia, Georgia, on May 2nd, 2002. Thousands of people attended, and she was buried at Hellendale Memorial Gardens in Lithonia. Now, after her death, the schools continued to be built, and eventually they were built on an 80-acre plot of land that she called Camp Yak. The other center was called Creative Castle. In 2003, her family started the Lisa Lopez Foundation, a charitable group dedicated to providing neglected and abandoned youth with the resources necessary to increase their quality of life.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Her foundation went on to do various, projects in underdeveloped villages, gave new clothes to poor children and their families. And it continues to this day to do work. They began hosting an annual music festival called the Left Eye Music Festival in Decatur, Georgia, a couple years after her death as well. And then the documentary that I'm mentioning, The Last Days of Left Eye, premiered at the Atlanta Film Festival in April of 2007. So it took a while because, people were mourning. And most of the footage was shot with a handheld camera, often in the form of diary entries. I watched some of it, and it's very powerful. Filmed by her on a 30-day spiritual retreat with her sister Raindrop, her brother Ronald, and members of a group that she was managing called Egypt.
Oh.
In these entries, she reflects on her personal life and her career. And she's actually very calm, and she's meditating, and it's like a calmer side of her personality. And it was showcasing her interest in numerology, spirituality, and yoga. in 2008, her family worked and finally created an album in her honor called I Legacy. Just on a closing note, I have two quotes. So in a statement to MTV, music producer Jermaine Dupri, who was a big producer in the area, you know, he is one of the few people who's responsible for shaping the Atlanta scene in the 90s and really turning it to like the thing that it is today. So he said to MTV, quote, "She was determined to be something in life. She was a true rock star. She didn't care about no press. She was a rock star out of the group. She was one that would curse on TV. She had the tattoos. You could expect the unexpected. When you see Lisa, you could expect something from her. That's the gift she carried," end quote.
That's amazing.
But for her, I feel like it's only fitting to end this episode with in her own words. That's from the documentary.
Okay.
The Last Days of Left Eye.
Okay.
In the final moments of the documentary, she said, quote, "I think my life represents change. I love change. I'm trying to change for the better. I'm changing right now." She goes on to say, "There are so many things to explore. It never ends," end quote.
Oh.
So hopefully the spirit of Lisa Left Eye Lopez lives on.
Yes.
And that is my notorious woman.
Honestly, so. I love TLC so much.
Yeah.
And I didn't know most of this.
Yeah. I didn't know like about her earlier stuff. You know, I knew about like the struggles, like, but like,
she showed up in headlines every so often, but yeah. I remember thinking like, I still love her. Eh, it's not her
fault.
And
also I remember like, they were so like cool. I love that they weren't like too sexualized, but they were actually talking about sex, which is interesting with their first single. But I love like they were very tomboyish and like, you know, I love her.
Yeah.
I loved her flow. I love her rap style. Like, but I also love that she had that spunk, because even though the fire was, you know, obviously was contributed to probably her drinking. But the fact that he's smacking her around, she's like, motherfucker, this is not
she did what she had to do.
I mean,
I'm not like promoting arson or anything.
But it's like. And I mean, Andre, in his defense, like, again, these are two young people with a lot of fame all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And they probably didn't have good role models or someone to talk to. You know, he's deep into toxic masculinity.
Probably.
She's deep into like, you know, childhood trauma that's unresolved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
You know, and then frustrations with, because again, now we're realizing that they're only being paid $50,000 after their first album drops. So there's a frustration with that.
Also, everything that happened between the two of them is alleged.
Is alleged, exactly.
Okay, I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah, and it's like, it's not, we're all adults now, and it's like we can see that they were doing the best they could, and they made mistakes. And even though I say stab, 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 don't burn people's houses down.
Yeah, it's not great. Not great.
So, I mean, you can think in your head, stab, 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 but don't like, just actually, honestly, in all seriousness, if you're in this kind of situation, walk away.
Yeah.
Just separate. Don't be with, you don't need this kind of drama. You don't need law to get into it. I mean, thank God she only got probation and that was the impetus for her to go to rehab. Like, but it could have gone really, really bad. Like he could have died. She could have died in that fire. Like somebody else could have died. So don't, in all seriousness, I joke about that, but just walk away. Like
actually just walk away. But you can think.
And write in your journal, stab, 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 stab.
Right.
I once heard this this comedian, and I'm still just from her. She had this like punchline. She was like doing this stand-up routine, and she was like, "Here's my poem to this man: stab your black ass, stab your black ass." That was always her refrain, like her chorus. "You hit me because you've been out with the other ladies. Stab your black ass. Stab your black ass." So, on that note.
That's a fabulous
note. That wraps it up for another episode of the Notorious Women Podcast. Guys, remember to follow us on all the things. Also, go to the Apple Store and leave us a 5-star review. It helps people find us.
Yes.
We have about 32 reviews, which I think we should probably read some of them to get people, encourage people.
We should.
So we'll start doing that next episode. But we'd love to get that up to like 100, 200 reviews. Like,
it can be quick too. Just be like, they're the most beautiful women I've ever seen. You know, just like be honest.
Exactly. Just remember to do that. And also you can, if you want to help support the show in other ways, you can go to our patreon.com, patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And leave us some money. You can follow us for as little as $2 a month. Now that our schedules are opening up a little bit, we're going to start adding more material to that. But, if you just want to say, you wanted to say that you love us, and you want to support us financially, you can also do a one-time payment. You can do, like I said, $10, $5, $20, $20,000.
We would actually be okay with $50,000.
Yeah, we could do that.
Like, just so you know. I don't want to think that we would be offended.
I mean, there's some rich person out there is like, I need a tax write-off.
We got you.
We got you.
We got you. Okay.
$50,000 off the top. Give it. Yeah. We got you. So
no problem.
Miriam, how else can they support the show?
They can follow us on Instagram. Pretty Please with a Cherry on Top. Follow us. Tell your friends to follow us. It is Notorious Women Podcast. It's so easy. We're also on the TikTok, Notorious Women Podcast. We are also on YouTube. You can listen to episodes on YouTube as well as Notorious Women Podcast. Very repetitive, so you'll never forget.
Yep.
Also, you can email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. If you have any thoughts or ideas, we're here for you. Yep. And that is that.
All right, guys. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.